Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Elhamdülillah. Vessalatu vesselamu ala Rasulillah ve alihi ve sahbihi ve men vela. If you've strolled down the road recently to Trafalgar Square, you'll see that the empty plinth is empty no longer. You may recall that after the Napoleonic Wars, they erected images of various victorious generals and admirals and other worthies, and after the First World War, Edith Cavell was added, but there's one plinth that is empty. But empty no longer, because a few months ago, Boris Johnson unveiled the Cockerel. Anybody seen the Cockerel? This is an enormous 20-foot-high fiberglass blue Cockerel that stares myopically down Whitehall in the general direction of Westminster Abbey. The only nice thing about it is that it is a quite fetching ultramarine blue. Around it, there's the usual tourists and children playing. But what there isn't is any indication of meaning. It's by Katharina Fritsch, who's a reasonably well-known German sculptress. But what does it mean? We know what Admiral Nelson signified, what Jan Smuts signified, what Edith Cavell signified. But what is this fiberglass cockerel doing on the empty plinth in Trafalgar Square? Well, of course, as anybody nowadays will tell you, it's there because we have nothing else to fill the plinth. The national imperial narrative is at an end, and the religious narrative which it replaced is certainly at an end, so we might as well fill the space with a fiberglass cockerel. Why not? Does it signify anything? Well, blue used to be the colour of heaven, but of course not any longer. Cockerels even used to indicate a proclamation, annunciation, something new, but of course it doesn't mean that either. What it means, like everything else in modern art, is that meaning itself is at an end. And what we're doing is really enjoying the enormous free void that has been opened up by the departure of ontology, metaphysics, religion, ethics, everything that used to restrict and restrain us. This is an interesting time to be alive because it is a turning point probably more drastic than the Enlightenment itself. It's the end of the Enlightenment. We are post-Enlightenment now. The Enlightenment kicked God off the plinth and replaced him with human beings, our glorious selves. We were to be the measure of all things from the time of Hume through Diderot to D'Holbach and Kant. That was what modernity would be. To be modern was to be ungodly, and to make man the measure of all things. But if what we have now is a fiberglass cockerel, the Enlightenment surely is at an end. So what do we have? We have what Zygmunt Bauman calls liquid modernity. This is his new book, which many of you will have looked at, Culture in a Time of Liquid Modernity. He begins with Bourdieu's observation that culture used to be there in order to give people a sense of what class they belonged to. People would listen to opera to reassure themselves that they belonged to an elite. People would sing football songs to reassure themselves that they belonged to the working class. That was the principal function of culture. It was about class. Nowadays, however, in our time of liquid modernity, we don't really belong to classes any longer. We might go to the English National Opera one evening, but the next evening we'll go to a football match. We might have a pizza tonight, but tomorrow night we might go to Stringfellows, and it's all mixed up together, and that's the nature of what he calls liquid modernity. That also is a sign of the end of the Enlightenment paradigm. There is no more high culture or low culture. It's all mixed up together. And the only thing that keeps it going is this extraordinary energy that is being unleashed by the absence of meaning. That's a pretty enormous energetic void. And we're all in this cauldron together, bubbling away, because it's really mobile. The tape mobile, tape modern is really alive, and technology keeps us, you know, literally mobile. There's a new phone every 6 months, and we have to get it, otherwise we're last year's men. Everything is moving, but the only thing that keeps it moving is the fact that it's not going anywhere. We're not utopians any longer. We're no longer part of a story. We don't have a narrative, religious, national, or class, or anything any longer, but there's always something new. And even when old stories are allowed to obtrude, they have been gutted, eviscerated, hollowed out. Russell Crowe as Noah for instance. Fine, you can make $1 billion out of it, but on condition that you take the meaning out. Then it can be modern. To be modern, to be successful, to be the object of participation in the modern or the liquid modern capitalistic process, you have to take out the meaning, you have to take out the eschatology, you have to take out the God bit of the Noah story, and then you can fire up the synapses in the brain, because what a great story. That's where we are. That's the condition in which we, as Muslims, find ourselves as kind of spectators, because to the extent that you're really Muslim, or I guess Catholic, Jewish, something else, you can't jump into that cauldron and enjoy the fizzing and the bubbling of the thing that's constantly moving and that is trading on the absence of meaning and narrative. You have to be a concerned spectator. And that's our predicament. Everybody's saying, come in, it's great fun. There's nothing else going on. The cauldron is where it's at. Be cool. But we're saying, well, no, we actually rather like having a narrative, having a story, having life after death, having meaning, having prophets. Sorry. And so there's this polemic. They can't stand us because we, as Muslims, are the ones who most conspicuously don't jump into it to join the party. We're not very happy with it. We don't like the erosion of even fundamental aspects of identity. If anybody here has recently joined Facebook, you'll notice that even a few weeks ago, when you joined Facebook, you had to pick your gender and it was male or female. No longer. Now you get a choice of 50 different genders. Why? Because even the enormous corporate megastructure and power of Google and Facebook have to collapse when these new identity politicians have their say. And so nobody can be offended, and anybody can choose whatever sexuality or gender or fundamental human affiliation they might choose, because that's part of being yourself. We can't define the self any longer. We don't believe in the soul. We don't even believe in anything much that is selfhood. The neuroscientists continue to pick away at that, but still, be yourself, pick your gender. We Muslims are not into that, and that means that we are kind of orphans or concerned spectators, and everybody is shouting at us for not playing the game, for not really believing in the game, but to the extent that we're believers in something higher, something within, we can't play that game. It's fun, modern art is brilliant, but we don't believe in this endless interrogation of meaning, in this endless challenge to our stereotypical way of seeing the world. Take modernist fun. There's one installation, it's Tracy Amin telling us, challenge your stereotypical way of seeing the world. And so it's challenged. We move on to the next one, and it's Gilbert and George or Damien Hirst. Challenge your stereotypical way of seeing the world, and it's challenged. And by the end of it, well, a lot of energy, a lot of challenges, but they haven't put anything in the place of all of that stuff that they have just hollowed out. So let's go to another gallery or another postmodern opera and get some more of the same. And that's the energy. Zygmunt Bauman talks about it in this liquid modernity where everything has been liquidized. This takes us on to the issue of economics, which is a kind of parable for everything that's happening now. 1914 is the year which is referred to in Rafae's book as the time when this crisis was triggered. 1914, the beginning of the Great War. The beginning of the end of the old system. If you read, for instance, the autobiography of Osbert Sitwell, who came of age in 1914, and how he recalls how everything changed so fundamentally, the final sunlit summer of Edwardian England replaced by this incredible meat grinder, genocidal, efficient, industrial, nationalistic thing. That's when the old order really ended, but it's also the year, not so many people were aware of this, when the gold standard started to crumble, because Germany came off the gold standard in 1914. In many ways, that's a more fundamental transformation than the beginning of the sort of genocidal mega-conflicts of the 20th century, because wars come and they go, but we're still off the gold standard. What does that mean? From a Sharia perspective, it means that we are decentered, that meaning has gone, that there is no referentiality. That whereas once, and you can see even the ancient Egyptians loved gold, it's axiomatic in all human cultures, the Aztecs, the Chinese, gold is there. It's the material of heaven because it's to do with sun, just as silver is to do with the moon. It's to do with the cosmos itself. Inherently valuable because, not just because people like it, but because it's inherently scarce and because it's untarnishable and has this incredible symbolic astral value. We come off it in 1914, and then America and England come off it, and then you have Bretton Woods and the creation of this new world, which again is kind of post-Enlightenment, because here there is no measure of all things. Instead, money is what we think it is worth. Instead, it's all fiduciary. It's all smoke and mirrors. How do I know that this £5 note in my pocket is worth £5? Well, it's not worth an equivalent amount of gold intrinsically, although I could exchange it for gold if I wanted, but it's not linked to gold any longer. It's just because the banks are telling me that it's worth £5. And even that, as you can see, fluctuates, and there's the Forex exchanges and money. It's kind of a very brittle thing. It's the essence of what the modern world is about. It's not just the business of America is business, the business of the world is business nowadays, and politicians succeed or fail primarily on economic indicators, not because they make a nation proud culturally or militarily, but because of the rise and fall in the stock market. This is where we are now. It's a mercantile age. But the actual stuff of it is no longer related to anything that's real. And so the end point of this, 100 years after the beginning of the end of the gold standard, we have things like Bitcoin. What is Bitcoin? Well, you have to take it seriously. You can even go online to Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic website and buy a ticket to go to outer space, paying entirely with Bitcoin. So it's real on some level. And it's capitalized, I don't know, over $1 billion. It's real, but what is it? You can't even touch it. At least I can console myself by touching the £5 note in my pocket and knowing that I can take a bus home. But Bitcoin, it doesn't exist at all. And it comes and it goes, and its value is as volatile as the system has to be when it's not linked to anything real, anything tangible in the real world of scarce minerals. It's just somebody's story. It means whatever the market thinks that it means. So, as it were, a pun from Fort Knox, we go to Mt. Gox. Mt. Gox is this biggest of all Bitcoin exchanges, which collapsed recently, and just discovered that somebody had hacked its virtual site and all of the Bitcoins had been stolen. And so everybody got an email saying, sorry, your pension has gone. And Bitcoin doesn't actually exist in any legal world because it's not the national currency of any country. So it's gone, it's gone. Consolation prize, though, they did find some more in some neglected Bitcoin wallets that they just happened to look at. And so they found a few 100,000 Bitcoins that way. But very strange. This kind of world of volatility, money that never existed, suddenly being conjured into reality and then vanishing again. Was it there in the first place? Where did it go? Has to be answered with the answer, was it there in the first place? But maybe all modern currency is like that. Maybe actually the greenback is like that, because it's based only on what governments say that it's worth. And the economy now is in a very weird situation. Because after the collapse, which was really a classic kind of riba bubble in the noughties, when the subprime mortgage racket in America was finally exposed, you know, getting really poor Americans into catastrophic levels of debt just so that you could bundle these toxic debts and sell them on the stock exchange. Horrible stuff. Hundreds of billions were lost. And so banks collapsed. Governments had to step in by getting money from where? Not from gold and silver. The Bank of England in London down the road is still sitting on bars of gold, but they didn't get it from there. They got it from kind of inventing money, quantitative easing, printing money. The Fed prints $55 billion worth every month, and they say, oh, we've made more money. Here it is. And of course, the stock market goes up, and the Standard & Poor's 500 goes up 23%, even though real incomes are not increasing, and inflation is there, but still strange. A bubble built on the back of a bubble on the basis of credit ratings, credibility, looks very, very unstable. And the chances are that once interest rates goes up, things like the mad property bubble that we're experiencing right now here in London, completely mad. Salaries go up at less than the rate of inflation, but property prices go up 13% in this city last year. This is just madness, a bull market, people riding it, hoping that they'll get off in time. Well, most people don't get off in time. Even the smart economists who are engaged in this witch doctor science called economics, which has no predictive power whatsoever. They're the ones who get caught out with their clever equations. They can't predict anything. So it's gambling, as well as being usury, as well as being greed, and the whole world is based on it. The whole world is built on it. The emperor has no clothes, just like the stupid cockerel outside the National Gallery is. Classic example of that. It's just a stupid blue cockerel. It doesn't even claim to be meaning something. Maybe that's more honest than economics, which does claim, but you know, at least the world is supposed to be built on it. And that's the situation we're in. So this is where revelation comes in and why Muslims are not like those who do not know. The Quran says this in a very discriminatory way. Let's be frank about it. Are those who know equal to those who do not know? Our economics has to be rooted ultimately in the naqdain, gold and silver, which have intrinsic scarcity. And this kind of boom-bust, mad, speculative cycle, human greed, building and building castles in the air until it collapses again, and usually it's the poor old bus collector who doesn't know what's going on, who loses his money because he doesn't get out in time. Usually the weak, the poor, who suffer most in times of economic collapse, and the elites have salted away their gold stocks somewhere in Zurich, and they're all right. Horribly iniquitous system is getting worse and worse, but the prophetic model is not that. But that's not really the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that modernity is inherently fissile, volatile, that artistic fashions now would have been regarded as repugnant 20 years ago, and that our fashions now in art and music and literature will be regarded as, nobody will be looking at them probably in 20 or 30 years' time. It's ephemeral. Similarly with phones. Who's going to have one of today's iPhones in 20 years' time? There'll be some other weird thing, brains communicating directly to brains, or God knows what they'll be doing. Everything is liquid, but economics also liquid, with the result that we have this incredible instability and volatility, the bouncing around of booms and busts, with the poor and the weak and the not so bright always paying the highest price. But that is not quite my point. No, I'm not moralizing in that sense. What I'm saying is that if you have access to revelation and you do believe in the ultimate gold standard, you do believe that values are not just relative in this smoke and mirrors world which modernity has created for itself, but are rooted in absolute principles, discernible, albeit sometimes with a lot of argument, through revelation, then you're not playing that game at all. And when there's a crisis, you will have some sort of qarar, some sort of stability. Look at those poor souls who sunk all of their pension money into bitcoins only to get the email from Mt. Gox in Tokyo saying, sorry, but somebody's pinched all the bitcoins and there's no court that has jurisdiction and you're out of luck. Now, the one who believes only in the smoke and mirrors of dunya, in this fiduciary system, who believes in the fundamental presumption of modernity, which is that human worth is to be measured on the basis of earning power, is going to be shattered. Suicide rates always mount when there's a recession. But what about the person who has tawakkul and who believes in tijaratan and tabur, who accepts this extraordinary ironic deconstruction that we find in the Quran of mercantile language to refer to the really important transaction? Deen means a transaction, which is not human beings being greedy with each other and but paying their taxes, but means instead human beings acknowledging that they have a source and an author and a designer to whom they are accountable and before whom they will appear, and who is not going to ask us, well, how many bitcoins we have. You can be pretty sure. You don't need to find the explicit dalil in the Quran and the Sunnah, but you're not going to be asked how many bitcoins you have in your wallet at the Yawm al-Qiyamah. It's not an issue. Instead, we're old-fashioned and archaic enough to say that it's human quality that matters. Excellence of soul. Fada'il. يَوْمَ لَا يَنْفَعُ مَالٌ وَلَا بَنُونَ إِلَّا مَنْ أَتَى اللَّهَ بِقَلْبٍ سَلِيمٍ. What counts at that point, the incredible wrinkle at the end of time when time itself stops and things become clear at last, what happens at that point is The qalb salim is what counts. If the heart is sound, full of dignity, sacrifice, duty, patience, compassion, the traditional list of virtue, basically you're all right. And that's what the believer aspires to. Even if you've lost all of your pension, thanks to the wizards at Mt. Gox, it doesn't matter. So that's the certainty that dhyana, that religiosity gives. That's why religion is not less relevant, but more relevant in times such as our crazy times, times of liquid modernity, where everything is whizzing about and there's no settled narrative for anything, where human beings are constantly being buffeted by powerful winds, and we need some sort of reassurance. And the only real assurance the heart craves is that there is hope, that there is meaning, that there is light at the end of the tunnel, and that light is nur samawati wal ard, light of the heavens and the earth. So I'm not going for the naqdain moral argument, but I'm going for another kind of moral argument, which is that we need deen more, given the crazy nature of the modern economic world, than we ever did in the past. Because when there was a gold standard, things were kind of quiet. And you inherited money that originally was bequeathed by your great-great-great-grandfather, and it went into some stock, and it was always there. Nowadays, who knows, inheritance tax, capital gains, nothing has a state of qarar any longer. So instead, what do we need? We need this virtue of tawakkul. That is the only alternative to the kind of Prozac-fueled anxiety culture which is increasingly oppressing humanity. And the Muslim world as well. Let's not moralize about that. The Muslim world is also freaked out by this thing, and there are big modern art museums in the Gulf and elsewhere. One hopes that they're patronizing modern art because they understand what it is. In other words, it's an extraordinarily powerful denunciation of what happens to the soul when it loses touch with meaning. Maybe they understand that, maybe they don't, but they're buying a lot of it, certainly. Half of Damien Hirst is now in most places. But they've also bought into the international corporate world of mega finance. The Islamic banks, to the extent that they are Islamic, are the world's great dissident, honorable exception to that. And the incredible difficulties that Sheikh Hill will tell you a thousand times more authoritatively than I could, of actually making that work without just being part of the cauldron. This is an ongoing discussion for the jurists, for the moral philosophers, and for others. But at least we're trying, and the world needs to have some respect for that, that we're not just motivated by trying to do the best that we can in this world of value that has no value, but we're struggling for a better model. So this is an important book. Thinking about the meaning of the measure of our wealth is something that we need to do. De-essentializing and, as it were, de-idolizing money, which is the great measure of everything in today's world, is something that we really need to do. You don't even need to be particularly theological to see that in itself it's not something that's worth anything any longer. And so what should we do? Well, a final moral point. If you want to put it in a really safe investment, well, stocks and shares, who knows, quantitative easing is going to taper and maybe not that. Gold, well, it's low at the moment, and about gold. Property, well, it's a bubble. Where should I put it? Simple nasiha, put it in the only bank that's never going to fail, which is the Sadaqah Bank. How about that? Give it, that's the message of zakat and sadaqah, give it and give it and give it, and then you can be sure that you'll get your dividends at the end of life, after retirement, which is longer than retirement itself, actually, if you think about it. That's where we should be investing. And that's another of the countercultural and strange things about our economic system, which is that we factor tithes and almsgiving and charitable giving into the whole system more axiomatically than any other civilization does. And that's also mentioned in this book. Barakallahu fikum, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.